The following program is a PodcastOne.com presentation.
Break it down like this.
Over? Did you say over? Nothing is over until we decide it is. Who's with me? Let's go! Come on!
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Chive Podcast. You know, one of the things I love about doing this podcast is you really never know what you're going to get. Last week was the podcast that wasn't, where we had Steve Ranazzisi scheduled to be on the podcast. He pulled out the day before, obviously, because he had lied about being in the Twin Towers at 9/11.
Yeah.
And then this week, we have an actual American hero on the show.
Yeah, right.
Ken Ham, of course, the astronaut, who was nice enough to... He didn't fly us out to Vegas. We flew out to his brand new house in Las Vegas.
Happily flew out to Vegas for your birthday weekend.
Yes.
It couldn't have been any better. And you're right, though, man. Like, every week, you never know what's coming. No. We never know what's coming. We find out, you know, sometimes days before, you know, like, all right, so that's our next interviewer. That's where we're going next. Next week, we're going to New York. It's just been, it's a whirlwind, man.
Yeah, it's Ed Burns in New York. Yeah. This has been a whirlwind. I have really enjoyed this ride. And I was also looking for something to do on my birthday. So I was like, Ken, where are you now, by the way? He's like, you know, I'm just outside Las Vegas. Okay.
Yeah.
Plane's booked at like warp speed. Smoke rising off of my laptop computer.
Oh, this is two birds with one stone for sure, man.
Yeah.
And you invited me and my wife out, and we had friends. It was a fantastic time out there.
Well, I felt so bad because, you know, last week on the podcast, it wasn't, you know, we talked about all sorts of subjects, including your wife's amazing ass. Yeah. I brought that up. So
it came up in dinner conversation.
It was.
In Vegas, yeah.
Yeah, and I felt bad about that. I was like, you know what? I got to make this right.
Yeah.
You know,
I
got to bring Laura out to Vegas.
Yeah.
So I can stare at her ass.
I was like, the long stares weren't helping anything. Those bathroom breaks were her just composing herself. Like, he's such a creeper. I don't know what to do with him.
We're going to make the intro pretty short today because the interview that we did with Ken Ham is something that you're really going to enjoy.
Yeah.
I mean, every topic came up from taking an F-18 Super Hornet into space, or at least attempting to asking him whether he thinks astronauts have ever had sex in space. What's it like to dock with the International Space Station? What's it like to corkscrew through re-entry into Earth's orbit at night?
Thoughts on Mars. All kinds of things. Man, we had so much that we were just like, we don't know anything about how this works. Please let us pick your brain for a couple seconds. And he spent an hour and a half talking to us, man. He spent a while. It was great.
Amazing. It's a very dense podcast, but it's like a roller coaster ride at the same time. Every single question that you ask gets an answer that you never expect.
Mm.
So we'll kick it over to him real quick. And right now we're going to get to the round of ridiculous questions. But before we do, your season-long fantasy football team may still be going strong, but you don't have to wait till week 16 to get paid. Put your fantasy skills to the test every week this season at DraftKings.com, America's favorite one-week fantasy football site. With one-week fantasy, there are no season-long commitments. If you got an injured player, no problem. It's like a new season every week, and you never get stuck with the same players. And get this, DraftKings is now crowning a new millionaire every week this season. That means you could turn your love into football into a payday of a lifetime. Just pick your players, pile up points, and pick up the cash. That's it. Believe me, you've never experienced football like this before. This isn't fantasy as usual. This is DraftKings. Welcome to the big time.
Oh, I really wanted to
Welcome to the big time.
I really wanted to say it.
Hurry to DraftKings.com now. Use the promo code CHIVE and play for free for your first deposit in this Sunday's $1 million fantasy football contest, where first place takes home $100,000. Enter Chive for free entry now, only at DraftKings.com. That's DraftKings.com. DraftKings.com, Bob?
DraftKings.com.
Welcome to the big time.
Welcome to the big time. I'm sorry. You were giving it to me to say welcome to the big time.
That's DraftKings.com. Bob?
Welcome to the big time.
God, I always want to say that.
I want to work on that. It's going to be fun. But yeah, so let's do a few questions. The round of ridiculous. As always, send all your questions to podcastquestions@thechive.com. We had a lot of great ones, and I'm loving it because we're getting a few more that aren't just Chive centric.
Yeah.
So we got the first one here is a relationship sort of themed question.
Yeah.
And I love stuff like that. Seriously, I ask us stuff about your family relationships, or you got a bad date or something that went awry with your boyfriend, girlfriend. Ask us stuff like that. I love things like that because I have no idea what the hell I'm talking about, but I can't wait to give you an opinion on it. So with that, let's go with the first question. It is from Katie, and she says, how do you deal with getting broken up with? I feel like my Chivet heart is crushed. First off, I'm sorry, Katie.
Katie.
It happens to all of us. Well, actually, has it happened? Have you been broken up with?
Oh, of course, yeah.
All right.
Many times. And I know you're king of heartbreak.
I was just happy I was in a relationship, you know? It was like, well, you know, at least I had it.
Yeah, when you get dumped, you're like, thank you for everything. You're you like, you're still grateful.
Yeah, turn in my card here. Thank you. That was a good time. For me, let me just say, like everybody else, it blows. You get that sinking feeling. You feel worthless. You wonder, did I do something? Or worse, it would be good if you actually did something. You're like, oh, I dropped the ball. I really fucked up.
Yeah.
At least then you would have a reason. But no, what's worse is when you're like, am I inherently flawed? I'm just not good enough. And I think that is something that probably resonates for a lot of people is that self-worth and their own image takes a big hit. I don't know about you, but for me, I always think, you know, if you got friends and family and things to fall back on, if you got hobbies, you know, really ramp up your activity, you know, like there's that great line from True Lies. He goes, you know, when my life turns to dog shit, I just go to work, you know, maybe you got some work, maybe there's something you can get inspired by, but just get busy. Just get busy doing something.
Find a distraction.
Yeah, something. That's what I would do. What do you do?
I don't really have anything to add to that. I would say just know that it gets better, and it's not going to get better overnight. You know?
You're right.
Every day is going to be a little better than the day before, as long as you can achieve some sort of separation from the person that has broken up with you or that you've broken up with, whatever. Because a lot of, you know, there's that lingering relationship, you know, where you end up sleeping with each other like 2 weeks down the road because it's so familiar to you.
Mm-hmm,
that's actually never – if you're really breaking up or getting dumped, you got to let it go.
Yeah.
And you got to let the other person go. You can find that friendship down the line, but for like a month or two, I usually try to get away from the person and try to start your own life with you, Bob.
It's
finding your hobbies, new hobbies, things like that.
You know, don't look up what will make you feel better on WebMD. You'll only find out you have colon cancer.
That actually has nothing to do with relationships. That's just what Bob does every day on WebMD.
I just say, will this help me?
Yeah, Bob's the king of self-diagnosis. And your self-diagnosis always ends with, I'm going to die.
I'm going to die. I'm going to die. No,
so
you're
when
not.
You get dumped, it's like an actual physical ailment for you. You go to WebMD.
Yeah.
You type in, just got dumped.
Yeah.
What's going to happen?
I'm having heart palpitations totally happening to me right now. There's definitely something wrong.
Well,
no, yeah, I think that's the best you can do. And
we've all had our heart broken.
Yeah.
There's no real great overnight remedy. There's no pill you can take. It's just time and try to get away from the boy and let him live his life. You live yours.
You'll find out
just fine.
You're probably not the right person for you in the long run, and you'll find somebody so much better for you. And down the road, you'll look back and
she spells her name Katie with a C, C-A-I-T-Y.
Yeah.
I've never met a Katie with a C that isn't a smoke show.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, the K's.
You know
you
this,
know
but whoever sent
from.
This in, the guy's probably lamenting the day he broke up with you, Katie, because you are so fucking hot.
Yeah. Just based on the C. Just
the
based,
C.
Yeah, that alone has you convinced.
Yeah. Well, you're going to be fine.
You're going to be just fine, Katie.
The next question I've got here. Yeah. Dear John and Bob, I hear the Chive tours that y'all had in your old office and even the new one. I know the Chive is huge, and you can't really have randoms come in willy-nilly, but the Chivers want in on the fun. When in the hell are y'all going to open a bar in Austin that we can come visit when we're in your area? You have and you own your own beer, and it seems that y'all drink a lot. We do. Open a damn bar so we can join in on the shenanigans already.
Yeah. Seriously.
Scott.
Yeah, I've had this thought before. So, I mean, I'm going to let you just answer because I'm curious. What is it going to be? Chive Bar? KCCO Bar? What would you call it?
I want my brother and I have thought about this a lot. I want a hidden bar with maybe just like this tarnished bronze plate on the outside that just has like the chive crown on it, and that's all that it is. So you only know.
A discreet little subtle thing.
You don't advertise for it.
It's a bit of a speakeasy.
Definitely.
Okay.
And I think when you walk in, you can have KCCO gold, black, or KCCO white wheat, and your choice of like three different grilled cheese sandwiches.
That's the key.
That's it. That's all you can have. Yeah. Or and some pickles, of course, and chips. And that's it. Like, I want it to be the most simple bar could ever walk into. You can have chips. It's not a production, but three. You can have cheddar cheese. You can have Monterey Jack. And then maybe something spicy that they make for you. And just a beer. Make it easy on everybody.
Really simplify everything for everybody.
And we've thought about doing this, and we certainly can. The only reason that we haven't is because I would be there all the time, you know?
Yeah, because to let somebody else run it, and what if you had hired an asshole?
Yeah.
Then they're starting to represent the chive, and behind your, unbeknownst to you, you've got a problem now representing your company in a bad way.
Having my companies right there, where I'm not a helicopter boss.
No.
I'm definitely a free range boss.
Free range.
But I like to do things right, you know, and I want to hire the right people. And also, there's booze there, so why wouldn't I want to be there? Mm-hmm. Suddenly, I'm at this bar all the time. You know, that's not exactly the revenue driver of this little empire, you know, but I'm there all the time because there's booze there and because I can't put the bar in the office. We did put the bar in the office.
Yes, we did.
I think the solution to this is invite more chivers to the headquarters on Fridays. And
That's
the easier solution than me gaining 30 pounds on grilled cheese sandwiches and just drinking booze all day behind the bar.
Yeah.
Ruining my life.
Getting high on your own supply. And I'm talking about the cheese toasties, of course. No, the grilled cheese. That's a great idea, man. And we would have to come up with little kitschy things if we had our own bar, you know, like, I don't even know what it would be, but it would have to be these really, you know, what could we do that would be cool? You know, chivers being good to each other, maybe it's like, if you rack a beer, then we all sing a song. I don't know. I'm just spitballing. We'll have PJ Fridays. I don't know. We'll come up with some things. You should actually come up with some ideas for us. What would be some really great ideas for us at a startup bar? What would we be doing as chivers?
Would you want the chive bar to look like on the inside?
You should give us ideas, and then we can figure out if it's worth it.
Because I'm so close to pulling the trigger on it. I want to do it.
Yeah.
And I know that we should. I know the chivers, when they come to Austin, they want that place to go.
Yeah. But it's got. They always decide for us, you know, the direction. We might as well let them sort of, you know, sail us in wherever we should.
You guys figure it out. What do you want the chive bar to look like? You tell me what we should have on the inside.
Yeah.
What it should look like. The only thing you can't, the food thing, I'm not going to get into. It's of three grilled cheese sandwiches, pickles, and some chips. That's all anyone needs in life.
Yeah.
But everything else is up to you guys. If you know what? Honestly, if we like the ideas, we'll fucking build it.
Yeah. It's that simple.
It really is that simple. Right. I want to do it, so I think it's a great question.
I'm going to leave it at that. Yeah. Again, send in those ideas if you have them to podcastquestions@thechive.com.
Speaking of which, I have to add that because we're talking about KCCO Gold and Black Lager, and the guys at Resignation Brewery, Joe and Pat, came in my office, and they were talking about how we want to give back to the country over the next couple months. So here at the Chive, we are trying to give back as much as we can to everyone who bravely serves our country. And from now until I think the end of November, Resignation Brewery is going to be donating a portion of the proceeds from every single KCCO beer sold. And it's going to go to the Patriot Pact Coalition. You know, that's fucking awesome.
That's amazing.
Like the perfect storm of charity. It's Marcus Luttrell. It's the Boot Campaign. Every great military charity is sort of rolled up into the Patriot Pact Coalition. And they're all working together to show their appreciation for our military by providing a massive amount of support for our heroes in need. So all you got to do is go to resignationbrewery.com to see where you can find KCCO beer. And every single time you purchase a case or six pack of KCCO Gold, KCCO White Wheat in Texas, you're going to support this great organization all the way through November. And on that note, Bob, let's go to Vegas.
Yeah. That was such a good note to end it on, man.
let's go to Vegas, sit poolside with an astronaut, and ask him every ridiculous question about being an astronaut that we ever wanted to ask.
I just can't wait.
It felt like being a teenager again.
Yeah.
We asked almost every stupid question that we ask, and it is the most fascinating, at least one of the most fascinating podcasts that we've ever done. So let's take it to Ken Ham.
It's really big this week on the Big Podcast with Shaq, as we're joined by Ludacris.
Hey, I want to commend you on the job you've done in all the Fast and Furious, but Fast and Furious 7 was probably my favorite.
Never in a million years did we think they were going to call us back four or five, and then six, seven, and, you know, now eight, to be honest with you. I think I can go ahead and put that out there on this podcast, let them know we start shooting eight in March.
Get me in, cuz. Can you crash me or something? Can you beat me up or something?
I'm going to holler at the people, see what we can do, man.
Yeah, man, yeah, something.
There's cars that you can fit in, man, so I'm trying to figure it out.
The Big Podcast with Shaq.
That's me. It's up right now at podcastone.com.
That's podcastone.com.
Hey, everybody, this is John Rezig. We're here in Las Vegas, Nevada, in the brand new house of Mr. Kenneth Ham.
Yeah. This place, the first thing I saw when I came in, it has a built-in bar.
Mm-hmm.
It has a breakfast nook. Both of these things I have spoken at length about that I am in love with.
Boring.
Yeah. like a tiki bar built into the back with the seats in the pool.
Now, there you go.
A slide. You know, with the water coming down, with a rock.
If I have to describe this thing to anyone,
please,
in just a couple words,
yeah,
swim up bar,
swim up bar, yes. Even the hot tub that cascades right into the pool.
Did you see the slide?
I saw the slide, yeah, on the rock cliff wall. Yeah. Oh my god, it's
the Phillip boys like a good hot tub. You have to understand, it's the first thing they notice about any sort of house, backyard. They immediately
water
go back,
creatures.
Yeah.
Assess the situation and ask if you have a hot tub, and if not, they immediately leave. Ken is one of my best friends, and I'm going to go ahead and read this. You're a retired, is it astronaut?
Actually, the term is former astronaut.
You're a former astronaut.
Yeah.
In the U.S. Navy, you have over 6,000 flight hours in more than 40 different aircraft with over 300 shipboard and 300 land-based arrested landings. What's an arrested landing?
Yeah, I know.
That's, in the Navy, you got to put the hook down to get the airplane to stop because the boats are small.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you put that hook down. That's called an arrestment. Those are some other stories about getting arrested. But
did we mention you've been to space twice, once as a captain?
Yeah.
Do you mean commander of a space shuttle? Correct.
Yeah.
Was it a space shuttle?
I was. Actually, it's really confusing. In the Navy, I was a captain at the time.
You were?
That was my rank.
Mm-hmm.
But I was serving as a commander of a space shuttle. I know it's confusing.
Yeah.
Just don't ask.
I build yourself up even more, Ken. And that's funny because Ken's one of the most humble guys I've ever met, and I'll tell you the story about how we met, and this is kind of fascinating. A lot of the Chive history goes back to myself on the back porch of the old Chive headquarters in Venice Beach. I would make my Bloody Mary every Saturday, and I would go back and try to give tours to people. So I walk outside, and there is this really nice guy with your friend Michelle, and you're holding a CD in the air.
Correct.
And I was like, oh, this is a nice-looking guy. You look like I could find you perhaps riding a riding mower somewhere in the Midwest.
Fair enough.
Normal-enough-looking Joe.
He's beautiful in alabaster.
Yeah.
And he's holding this CD up in the air, and I just think to myself, oh, that's very nice. He's made a mixtape for me.
It's something you can kindly throw away 5 minutes after he leaves.
Like, here, you throw this away.
Yeah. Do you remember what I said?
I have something for you that you need to see.
Yes, pretty much exactly what I said. I said,
as cryptic.
I said, you want to see this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you're holding, I'm like, and so at that point, I'm like, okay, absolutely. He's eccentric. I like that. Let's let him in.
Yeah.
So I end up giving you a tour of the Chime offices. Mm-hmm. You and Michelle are are walking around, and we end up just kind of hitting it off. Like, yep. I hate to say it was chemistry, but it was. We made eye contact. Mm. It lingered.
I remember hanging out in the place that had the live webcam, and I was calling on my friends going, look at the chive right now. That's me. That's me.
It wasn't 2 months after that and a few incidents occurred that we shut off the live webcam.
That was a liability. We needed to get rid of that Leo, camera.
Who is the most secure guy I know, wanted a live webcam. What happens if you put a live webcam at the chive offices? Mm. Nothing good.
Yeah.
So we get done with this tour, and you're in my residence in the back because I used to live on the chive campus, which I loved, and we're just chilling, having...
we were doing keg stands.
Yes, we were drinking a lot of beer. Literally, we were doing keg stands.
Yes, we were.
And I was like, oh my God, your mixtape.
Forgot all about
totally
it.
Forgot about your mixtape. Let's go ahead and hear this thing. I don't know if it's the new Dave Matthews Band or whatever. It was really sweet. And we plug it in the computer, and up pops an image from the International Space Station. And it's against the window, has been printed out, in green, keep calm and chive on. Somewhere over, was it Africa?
It was over the Atlantic Ocean on the Western African coast.
Yeah, so it's somewhere over Africa, and it's this keep calm and chive on. I immediately look at you, and I'm like, what is it that you say you do for a living, man?
You hadn't heard at this point. You had no idea who he was or what he was, yeah.
No, it's Riding Mower Ken.
Yeah.
From Northern Illinois.
Going to get a chive t-shirt.
Yeah,
and a
he's
beer
here for
with
a
me.
T-shirt.
Oh, and I did get some t-shirts. We were in the vault. I'm like, this is the vault.
We're coming back for those, by the way. So, you know, I hope you enjoyed it well.
Right.
Yeah, those are rent to own. Yeah. So that's really how we met, that you were an astronaut, and that was the most, like, fascinating thing. But it would really not... talked too much about you being an astronaut. We talk about topical things like friends do. And so Bob and I have been doing our research, and we have dug into your life. And now we want to talk about what it's like to come up as a kid. And Bob, you
in Plainfield, New Jersey. I want to talk obviously just a little bit about your experience in the Navy. And of course, we got to get to space and everything to do with that. But you grew up in, as a correct, Plainfield, New Jersey.
I was born in Plainfield, grew up in a little town called Clark.
Okay.
Yeah, right near there.
And I'm just thinking to myself, because everybody as a kid, they always say, like, oh, I want to grow up to be an astronaut. But it's like that stupid thing where you realize when you're like 15 years old, like, I was stupid. Like, there was no way that was never going to happen. I'm not smart enough or talented enough, and that's hard. There's only, how many people have been in space ever?
I think it's a little less than 550 of all humans. Yeah.
That is not much. In the pantheon of every person on this planet.
You actually refer to yourself as a vanilla astronaut, like you don't rank.
That's right, I am.
God, you're so humble.
But did you know?
You know, the special guys like land on the moon and do amazing things.
I'm sorry, you only...
Actually, vanilla's good, because you could be the worst, you know, the opposite of vanilla. I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Someone's got to go research that, what the opposite of vanilla is, but that could be because you screwed something up, and you don't want to be that astronaut.
Okay.
So vanilla's good.
Vanilla's good.
Yeah.
That's clean. That's a smooth operator.
That's right.
And you get the, and we'll get to that.
Was it your guidance counselor that suggested you join the Navy?
You're killing me. Why, yes, it was. How the heck do you know that?
So you're in your counselor's office. Mm-hmm. Most people would say that... like, my counselor was like, you're
I know
have
John
to...
doesn't do the research. Bob's got all the research
oh
going
my
on
God.
Here.
I'm thinking he's in the guidance counselor's thing, and there's literally a poster that says, shoot for the moon, and, like, success, and all those stupid motivational poster. And you're like, yeah. I'm going to, you know, so, but he convinces you, your guidance counselor, to go.
It's much simpler than that. I was a private pilot as a high school student.
Yeah.
Which... by the way, you get dates really quickly and easily.
I can imagine.
If you are, yeah. So that's a good thing.
That makes sense. Because, like, fast cars always get girls, I'm told. Right. I don't know this, but I'm told they get them, you know, all amped up.
And he's like, yeah, my Cessna has rims. They spinning.
Yeah.
Open the window. Yeah, it's really good stuff. And like we all did, we don't have any idea what we want to do when we're in high school. And he sat me down. He's like, okay, it's time. You know, he had... I had three older sisters that all went through the same guidance counselor. He said, it's time. You got to figure out what it is you're going to do with your life. I said, I have no freaking idea what I want to do with my life. And then he said, the key thing that is important for all young people is, what is it you like to do?
Oh,
I said, oh, that's easy. I love flying airplanes. And he pulled this picture out of the Navy Blue Angels. They were flying A-4s at the time. And I had never heard of, you know, barely heard of the Navy. Never heard of the Navy Blue Angels. He said, you want to do this? Do you want to fly in formation in jet airplanes? And I said, hells yes. And he gave me an application to United States Naval Academy. Filled it out and ended up going.
And it's funny because don't the Blue Angels now fly the F-18 Super Hornets?
They fly the regular Hornet, the Legacy Hornets. Yeah.
Okay, the Legacy mm-hmm. Hornets. Okay. And that is something that you would go on to fly many times.
I did. I ended up flying, yeah.
Is that your favorite plane?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is.
You flew 300. What would you say your favorite plane is?
Yeah.
Actually, the most fun airplane to fly is probably the A-4. I had a little model. It's not out yet. A-4 is a cool airplane. F-18 is a great strike fighter airplane. I'd take that to war any day.
But
good airplane.
I got to ask, did you ever try to take it to space?
Obviously, first question.
Right out of the gates, we come in hot.
It's funny that you mentioned that.
Can you define space for us, what the altitude of space is?
That's always debatable, particularly now in the world with commercial space flight. Everybody's trying to figure out exactly what makes a paying tourist an astronaut.
Wow.
You call yourself an astronaut. So there are a bunch of different lines in there. F-18 was never going to make it to space, but there was this time. Where normally when you fly around on a cruise, you got all these bombs and gas tanks and stuff hanging off your airplane. And we got back from cruise, and I had a great CO, and he said, okay, we're going to slick the airplanes off, make them drag-free as fast as they'll go. And we had a little competition in the ready room to see how high we could get one of these airplanes to go.
Let's preface the story by saying, what is the restart procedure on an F-18?
First you got to get the nose going towards the ground.
Okay.
So that the wind is going through the engines, to get it restarted.
Yeah.
That's sort of the tricky part. And if you can't get that part done, it's kind of scary.
Yeah, you're shit out of luck, I imagine.
Well, you got an eject button. Bunch of pissed off taxpayers.
And a lot of real,
that's the problem. There's a little aftermath to the eject button.
How do you get an F-18 to go higher and higher, to climb through
There's a fancy test pilot term, Ratowski climb, where you can get on this profile where you get supersonic and you get the nose pointed up and then you just go and see how far it'll go.
How far to go?
Well up into the 60s, which you're not ever supposed to be above 50,000 feet in an F-18 because technically you're supposed to have a pressure suit on just in case your engines stop.
Which is the funny
and the
thing.
Engines and the engines do stop, correct?
They do.
And then what do you do from 60,000 feet down to that 30,000 feet that we were talking about? Do you twiddle your thumbs?
Well,
do you try to regain control of the aircraft?
There are different phases to this.
Okay.
It starts with, you got to be shitting me. That's the shitting phase.
Fuck. Oh my God. So much money.
And then you start, trying to get things to work right, and they may or may not work right. So that kind of slowly transitions into just laughter. Like, wow, this is really going to be the end. And then
you're going out in a spectacular fashion, though.
And fortunately, as you get lower, the air molecules get closer together and the airplane starts behaving like an airplane again, and you can get it going in the right direction and get things restarted.
But the last guy, we won't say his name, he got it the highest, didn't he?
We won't say his name.
We won't, obviously. Yeah. But he got it the highest. Did he come in one of those moments, where they, on Seinfeld, where they were having the contest to see who could go the longest without masturbating?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then Kramer comes in first. He's like, I'm out! Was that roughly what happened with the last pilot who came in?
It was a collective through the junior officers in the ready room, collectively slapped the table, said, we are all out, because,
never doing that again.
Right. Yeah. Because it was, potentially losing an airplane.
Well, I mean, that plane is, what, $70, $80 million?
Oh, at the time, they were about $30
million. I take it back.
Yeah.
No paperwork is going to even need to be filled. And by the way, that plane goes, what is it? I wrote it down, 1,190 miles per hour.
1,900, Bob.
I'm sorry.
Or is it 1,190?
1,190 is that it's Mach 1.8. And,
it's very confusing.
But over 1,000 miles an hour, period, is insane. And that plane is just a monster. And it's just such a cool-looking plane. And the fact that you got to fly that, and yet 1,190, sort of in a weird way, pales into comparison to what you would eventually be strapped into and
yeah, that's
propelling
a whole
yourself.
Different experience.
Yeah. There's a bunch of young people listening right now, and I want to ask you, how do you sign up to be an astronaut? Do you sign up? Is there a form you can fill out?
Is there an
application? There is. There's an application. There's a request for astronaut candidates that comes out every couple of years.
How long had you been in the Navy when you filled this out?
10 years, something like that.
Ten years?
Somewhere around there. I was really lucky. In my day of joining astronauts, there were, because we were flying the space shuttle at the time, and there were two distinctly, clearly different categories of astronauts. There were the people that flew the space shuttle, which you had to be a test pilot to fit that category.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then there's all the smart people that have PhDs. Uh-huh. There's an S at the end of that. PhDs, many of them, master spin, all that kind of stuff. And I couldn't possibly compete in that category.
And yet you had a bachelor's in aerospace engineering in Navy, correct? In your college at Navy.
Right, right.
I mean, I think you're okay. I think you would do okay against the masses in an IQ contest. I think you're selling yourself short is all I'm saying.
Okay, I appreciate that. There's a lot of smarter people out there. Believe me, there are.
Believe me, we know. Than us. It is a constant.
You get accepted and you go to work for what, Capcom right away?
Oh, at NASA?
At NASA.
Well, everybody goes through a period of basic, they call it ASCANS, astronaut candidates. ASCAN training takes about a year or so. And you get busy and doing all sorts of different things. And then I was at Capcom for a while, which is working in mission control, sitting next to the flight director and translating engineer speak into pilot speak.
You were a capsule communicator.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Even though it wasn't a capsule anymore, it's a space shuttle. But yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And basically, they bring you guys in, though, because you can speak the language and articulate what's going on in the sort of the space shuttle to the people at the command center.
So that's a big part of it.
You're like a middleman of communication.
Yes, definitely. The Capcom job is a middleman of communication, and you got to get it right. So that's what you just said is all true. But what makes a good Capcom is one that can filter out the chaos of mission control. Because you're doing these simulations where all sorts of things are breaking and everything's going crazy and it looks like the shuttle's going to blow up and everybody's talking on the loops, we call them, the radio inside mission control. And then you have to key the mic and be very calm and say, you know, for the commander on the left side, switch panel R1. Flip this switch.
You're looking at the guys at the command, you're like, oh, they're so fucked.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
That's right. You let the key go and go, oh, God, cool. They're done. They're toast.
They have no idea what they're in for. Yeah, everything's cool, man. Just keep on that heading.
Just keep going.
When you were at Capcom, did you knew that the trajectory of your career was heading towards being an astronaut, or you didn't?
Yeah, no, that's the idea. Capcom is just a collateral job that you have when you're not training for a flight to be an astronaut.
Wow. My lateral job is going to the strip club. For example, managing one, possibly.
That's
my lateral move
in life.
I think. Or, you know, maybe managing a comedy club or something like that. So.
Perfect, man.
That's a good point. People are like, what would you do if you weren't working at the Chive? I'm like, I have no idea.
I don't know.
Is there an in and out around here somewhere I can just... I don't think I'm qualified for that. I don't know what I am qualified for at this point.
So then we've got a good hour and a half here. So I'm yada-yadding through some of your greatest accomplishments. But I want to talk about, is it STS-124?
That was my first flight.
That was your very first flight.
Mm-hmm.
There, and this was the Discovery?
It was.
And this is a famous flight in 2008.
I wouldn't call it a famous flight. Well, we brought up a big piece of space station. It was kind of cool to get all that going. But it wasn't any more important than any other shuttle flight.
What'd you bring up?
The Japanese experiment module, which is, it gets complicated how they name all that stuff. But it was the big, giant can, the piece of space station that is, I would say, largest that contains human beings that supports life. It's not a piece of the truss that holds solar arrays or anything like that, but it's a huge can.
How many hours did you put in? You go to the buoyancy lab, for example, and you train to bring this thing up. I mean, describe the buoyancy lab at NASA. I've seen it a couple times. Is that where you spent a majority of your time underwater?
So, in generally speaking, pilots and commanders, the people up front, don't do EVA, spacewalks.
Yes.
Extravehicular activity. In fact, I don't know if we've ever had one that did a spacewalk. However, you help in the coordination of all the mission specialists as they do their spacewalk stuff, and that all of that training happens in the pool. So those guys, the mission specialists, are in the pool most of the time. They let us go in a couple times just to see what it's like.
Is it cool?
Yeah.
Heck yeah, it's cool.
You know what the problem with the pool is? That there's still gravity in it.
Yes, yes.
So it's not real.
Physicist? Look at you.
No, I'm not. I am an English major.
Yeah.
And also theater. we could talk about Shakespeare in English later.
Can I talk a little bit just about shooting the first time you are literally on a rocket? Mm-hmm. You're on a space shuttle going, and I was talking about the speeds earlier. Top speed, what about 17,500 miles per hour? I don't know if your brain can process how fast that is. When you're going up, I mean, what is this like?
I wonder, but Chris Hadfield had a great story about it, that once you're strapped in to that candle, it's like Christmas times 10.
Yes.
Because, and you really don't think about the dangers, the consequences of what could go on. You've trained so hard that this, it's just pure excitement when you're strapped in.
Right.
How long were you strapped into the Discovery before it actually took off?
It's roughly about 4 hours.
That's got to be 4 hours of like, fucking, please light this candle.
Well, there's some of that. Fortunately, you're actually wearing a diaper at the time.
That's good. If you literally need to shit your pants, whether out of fear or otherwise.
It's all good.
You're all good.
You're all good. You're taken care of.
Yeah. And,
yeah, you're going to get downrange to about 18,000 miles an hour, but I mean, the first thing...
So can I talk about the speed?
I want to hear about every element of what happened.
I've sort of zeroed in on trying to how to describe what that speed sensation is like. And I'm going to use a word that it's integration. And I know that that's like a math term that we don't maybe all know, but it's you need an integrator. Mm-hmm. And here it is to think in everyday terms. If you're sitting at a stoplight in a car, passenger seat, sit back in the chair, close your eyes. Driver's driving, the light turns green. Hit the gas pedal, and you feel that sensation pushing you back in the seat.
Yep.
It's probably something like 0.1 Gs. It's just kind of pushing, easing into your seat. Mm-hmm. Your eyes are still closed. Your brain is actually what it's doing is it's integrating. It's integrating that acceleration force over time to give you a sensation of maybe 10 seconds later, you know that you're going 50 miles an hour.
Okay.
That makes sense, right?
Yeah.
0.1 Gs.
Yeah,
whatever. And the space shuttle, you're on your way to a little over 3 Gs.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so you're going uphill at 3 Gs, which is... a significant more, you know, I weigh close to 200 pounds. That's, you weigh 600 pounds in your seat. It's a much different sensation than sitting in the passenger seat of a car. And then instead of 10 or 20 seconds of stepping on the gas, you're doing that for 8.5 minutes. So your integrator, your integrator first goes, holy shit, we're going fast.
Yes.
And that's like after a minute.
Is it just shaking around you the whole vehicle?
It's rumbling and shaking. Oh, that's the other funny thing about it.
It's not like the Soyuz. This is it's a space shuttle. It has a lot of moving pieces.
7 million pounds of thrust.
Yeah.
It's a beast. The thing is unbelievable. And it's kind of funny. You do all this, like, you do years of training to get good at deciphering numbers and figuring out how that affects your engine so you can counter and fix things and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you get in the real space shuttle, and it's shaking so damn hard you can't even see those numbers.
There's no, because you can train and train and train, but there can't be anything like that experience
of
actually going up the first time through the atmosphere. Yeah. I was, you know, this thing it reminds me of is Spaceballs.
Yeah.
They go to ludicrous speed, and he's like, my brains are going into my feet, you know?
That.
I just can't imagine how your body is just overwhelmed with senses.
Exactly. That's it. I mean, your integrator actually breaks, which is probably the definition of ludicrous speed.
Probably.
So your integrator breaks. Yeah. Does it break around, the point of maximum dynamic pressure after about
a minute? No. It's
after that or before
that? I'd say,
that?
You know, 4 minutes into it, you're like, I can't keep track of this anymore. Because... The Mach meter's just going.
Yeah, and you're just like, all right.
You're on your way to Mach what?
25 is loosely when you leave the atmosphere. So Mach is defined by density of air and aerospace and all that kind of stuff. So once you're in space, you can't really call it Mach anymore. But right at the last second before you leave the atmosphere, it's about Mach 25.
And right when you leave the atmosphere, there's a story, I don't know if it's true or not, that astronauts will keep something around their person that is loosely hanging. I mean, you can call it a rabbit's foot. Something that tells them that they have reached space.
Yeah, Soyuz always does that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a thing. And they make a kind of a production out of picking what it is and all that kind of stuff. In shuttle, we didn't routinely do that, except when I was a commander on 132, had a great crew, great guys. Funny as could be. So yeah, on the launch pad we had a pair of fuzzy dice and a one of those little flat Christmas tree.
You had fuzzy dice on the space shuttle,
right there between me and the pilot.
Are you kidding?
They were there the entire flight.
The only thing that could be more cliche is the green Christmas tree.
That was the other thing. The flat Christmas tree.
The little green Christmas tree bobbing around.
It was there the entire flight.
You think it would be beakers and scientific equipment? No. We just want to have some dice, make sure.
And you see these little objects, they start to float at some point.
Yeah. Well, as soon as the engine's cut off, you're in zero gravity.
Does it become just insanely peaceful? Or no?
It eventually gets there. There's a lot to do as a pilot and commander, actually for the whole crew, to turn that spaceship from a rocket ship into a spaceship. Because it's a big transformation. It takes a few hours to get all that stuff done. After that's done, things get peaceful. And you really kind of like just look out the window and go, holy smokes.
And take it in. And you've seen pictures all your life, but you're seeing Earth from... like all everything you've seen and imagined, but now it's real, it's tangible, it is in front of
it
you.
It is visceral. It's amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Can I tell you my welcome to space story?
Please. Yeah. Which is
I was told that everybody's supposed to have one of those. So actually, this one stumbled into my lap. First flight, pilot of Discovery, like you mentioned, and we launched late in the day, going east as we always do when you launch, take advantage of this rotation of the Earth. And so we fly into darkness, right?
Yeah.
And it takes 8.5 minutes to use all the fuel. Now you're in space. And one of the first things we do is do essentially a flip with the orbiter. It's not important why we do it, but you do this kind of a loop almost kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so we're coming out of the backside of this loop, and I'm sitting in my pilot seat, and I've just shut down my hydraulics and engine and all that kind of crap. And I pull the helmet off my noggin, and I'm looking out the front windows of Discovery, and we're pointed straight down towards the Earth, and it's now nighttime. We're somewhere over Europe, I think like Spain or something.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing the beautiful lights of this city down there in Spain.
Yeah.
And right at that second, a shooting star goes by.
Oh, my
God.
You know, below me.
Below you?
Yes.
Like between you and...
Because this is that, knucklehead I am. Yeah. I never thought about it. Shooting stars they glow because it's the atmospheric friction of them going really fast.
Of course.
So the atmosphere is below you.
It's below you.
Yeah, I never put it all together. Yeah. So you see shooting stars below you now.
I wouldn't have thought about that.
I was like, oh, well, shoot. I'm definitely not on the surface of it.
Did you make a wish at least?
I did, and they all came true.
Oh, this is wonderful.
After I launch into space, I can tell you the first thing I'm going to want to do is probably, after I've gone on this ride, I want to come back down now. Like, good. I want to tell all my friends.
Yeah.
Fucking hammered drunk.
Yeah, yeah.
An astronaut now. Like,
you did the tallest roller coaster, and I'm out. I did it. I get my T-shirt.
You've got a job to do. Now you've got to dock with the space station.
Yeah, yeah.
There's different ways to dock with the space station. One is the way the Soyuz does it. One is the way the space shuttle does it, which is rather fast. Is that correct? How do you dock? How the fuck do you dock?
It's a great question.
With the space station.
Yeah.
Because you're up there now, but for the record, I'm already wanting to go back down because I'm an astronaut now and I'm going to get laid for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
That's
why you're in it.
Yeah, and just, I'm going to tell everyone at the bar, I'm like, you know what, babe? We had a job to do.
Yeah. I would literally have the glass helmet, like just sitting at the bar with me. I would never leave it.
I don't want to talk too much about it.
It's only a big deal if you make it one.
So now you've got to orient yourself. It's true or not that a lot of astronauts get sick in space right away?
I can tell you for myself.
Okay,
because I think it's relevant to the way you phrase that. You mentioned earlier lots of flight time in airplanes, and I've been flying since I was a little kid. I have never been sick in an airplane. Mm. Never thrown up. I felt a little queasy occasionally, but never thrown up.
Yeah.
Within 45 minutes of being in space, first time I was up there, I was puking my guts out.
Oh, wow.
But that doesn't mean everybody's like that. I've flown with crew members that would get sick in the T-38 flying with me all the time, went up there, and they're completely natural.
Weird.
Jeez.
Yeah.
But again, you can't train for that sensation. Yeah. It's got to be completely new.
How long does it take you to acclimate to that?
Less than a day.
Yeah.
Oh, less than a day of just being nauseous. Got it. I'm trying to get back down to the bar, to get laid.
Meanwhile, by the way,
I'm like sick in space, which is a whole nother thing. I don't want to deal with it.
You leave that part out of the story, though.
Can we go to the infirmary like they do in Aliens? Like, just leave me on a table somewhere, guys.
Yeah. But
how long does it take to get to the International Space Station from there?
The way we were doing it in Space Shuttle, it took about a day and a half, 2 days.
And aren't there multiple thrusters? How are you sort of – you have to, like, inch your way into the space.
It's wicked cool.
Yeah,
and,
please.
And, yeah, if we had, like, 5 hours to talk, and your listeners would just be so bored they would walk away. I love talking about –
like a two-minute offense of how that happens. bring it back to football
Fair
terms
enough.
For the layman.
It's a two-minute drill. Here we go. Space Station is about 1 million pounds. Space Shuttle, 250,000 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, the space station would hold its position. That was its job. And the space shuttle would maneuver, mm-hmm. you know, get from where you took the ball to 20 and get down to the goal line. And the space shuttle has 44 little jets that point off in all different directions. And you have a hand controller that actually have two hand controllers. One does all the rotational axes, pitch, roll, and yaw in your right hand. Left hand is X, Y, and Z, plus X, minus X, plus Z, plus Y. All that kind of stuff. And you move yourself around.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
It's like a video game.
Moving on.
We know that.
But the cool darn thing about orbital mechanics is that it is not intuitive. Like, if you want to go directly towards something, you can't thrust in that direction because you'll go in a different direction.
Oh, God.
And this is the part that takes a while to explain all that.
Yeah.
So there's an awful lot of simulation training, like literally thousands of hours of getting accustomed to what kind of control inputs to get in to put in to go in the direction you want to go.
Yeah,
it's really cool stuff.
But you did you dock both times? You're the captain on the first.
He's not the captain.
No.
Get this straight.
Well, I thought on the first mission you were the captain.
I was the pilot, and I was.
Oh, I'm sorry, the pilot.
And I was a Navy commander.
I did that twice.
And then I got promoted to captain in the Navy, and then I was the commander.
Yes, like I said, titles.
You got that?
Yeah. No. So sorry. And by the way, pilot. But did you dock both times? Is what I was asking.
No. See, there's another important thing to understand.
Yeah.
The pilot doesn't really fly much. The commander does all the piloting.
Isn't this, like, so counterintuitive? This sounds like the controls you just described.
Classified subterfuge, so you don't understand what's going on.
So, I know. Trust me. I don't.
Yeah.
I just want to try to get back down to fucking Earth right now.
Right. No, exactly.
And be a hero.
Yeah.
He's got a girl he needs to see.
If I wanted to ask, though, that picture... There's that picture you took. Oh, was shit. That in the – was it the cupola? Was that,
The picture of the Keep Calm, Jive On.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that – which is basically
that's in the cupola.
Observation kind of room, basically, in the
– Yeah, so that was – you know, every once in a while you have a good idea. And I had – I knew it was going to go over to L.A. and be near Venice Beach. I'm like, I need to get this picture. The freaking Chive guys will love this thing. So I emailed that picture. Emailed the
Keep Calm. Swanee. Was it Swanee that took it?
I can't remember. It might have been Swanee.
Yeah,
it might have been Swanee. And I said, dude, try this out, man. Just cut it out. Take a picture of it. Email it back to me. And that's obviously what you saw.
Wow.
I had another occurrence of using this, which is a much better use of it. Mm-hmm. A really good friend of mine, a test pilot, British guy, his wife passed away early. So I flew over to England, and I was at the service for her in a little tiny town, you know, stone churches, all that stuff in the back green countryside of England. And which is the cool juxtaposition of looking like 1800s England. And I took the program for her service, which had her picture on it.
Yeah.
And I took a picture of it. And between then and, like all Brits do, getting drunk later that day,
yeah,
mm-hmm. I sent it up to Space Station. A good buddy of mine was up there who's still an astronaut. I said, dude, did the same exact thing. And he took a picture of it, of her. And by that night, all of us sitting around the bar, you know, got to show that picture of her from space.
Oh my God!
After she just got, you know, buried, and it was so magical for that little tiny town to see the connection to the world in mm-hmm. space.
There's no more poignant moment, and you've actually done that for me because my grandfather, we took our grandfather to Normandy. Mm-hmm. Somehow, in this once in a lifetime moment, we were able to get all my cousins together, all the uncles. And bring my grandfather, served in World War II, back to Normandy. And my grandfather's an engineer. His sons are engineers. They're all engineers. I don't know what happened to me. But he had brought his kids to Cape Canaveral over the years to watch all the launches, and he is no bigger fan of space than my grandfather. And you had printed out a picture of my grandfather.
Well, you gave me a picture of him in his Navy blues.
Yes.
From World War II.
And that actually, and that was Swanee actual that picture that I gave you made its way up to space.
Yes, and it was Swanee that did that for you from space.
He tucked a picture of my grandfather. This is not something he printed up. It's something he put on his person for the launch.
Exactly.
And kept, like, in his spacesuit on the way up to put on that window, on that famous window, and take a picture down. And you said it best, points if you can do it over the south of France.
Yeah.
Because you can play games like that. Hey, man, can you position the space station over the south of France and go ahead and take a picture of John's grandfather on the way?
It's the north of France.
Oh, God, I just got back from the south of France. Jesus Christ. What? Here's the interesting thing. This podcast was either going to go up late or early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And late in Vegas, I knew I was going to be half drunk for this.
So, you're right.
This is just the way it's going out on the trucks.
No.
So it's the north of France in Normandy, which you managed to actually pull off. And my grandfather, I've never seen, he's not the kind of guy that cries, But when he saw that picture, and he didn't get it for a minute.
I saw it. The post was amazing. But still, is that the best post you guys have ever done?
It's the second most traffic post in the history of the Jive.
Well done.
And it was something that I didn't even want to do, but I thought I should do it, and so I did it. But my grandfather kind of to see that emotion sink in, how important that was to him to see that his picture had gone to space. He talks about it to this day. It's the first thing that he brings up with me, and it's not because he's losing his edge. He knows he's brought it up to me a million times, but he can't stop saying, just grabbing my wrist and saying, "Thank you for that."
Well, I think it's a connection to the future.
Talk
particularly
about
for
that.
His generation.
Yeah.
You know, my dad is 92, another World War II mm-hmm. veteran. Mm-hmm. And for him, technology, particularly spaceflight, is a connection to the future. I mean, think of what they grew up with, Buck Rogers, little sparklers coming out of a black mm-hmm. and white rocket.
Yeah.
And now they have people really doing it.
Yeah.
It's cool.
No. That's unbelievable.
Describe for us. So if you're finally in the space station, and sunrise and sunset is every 92 minutes?
Yep, pretty
How
much.
Do you keep time? What's
you look
the
at
central
a clock.
Time?
We use Greenwich Mean Time.
Okay.
Is it messing with your sleeping patterns? I mean, how are you dealing with light, dark, and just...
So when you go to bed, you got to black out all the windows because the sun is brilliant up there.
Yeah.
Unbelievably bright. So you put in blacked out panels in all the windows to make it dark and just everybody shut up, go to bed.
Yeah.
And of course,
it doesn't mess. It doesn't. Every astronaut I've met, which is you.
One.
I've asked so I was like, one question.
I was like, what?
One question for all the astronauts I've met. Yeah. Because you get a different perspective up there. What is it like looking back down at the Earth from up there? What is your unique perspective on that? What do you think? You had some time. You spent over a month in space.
Yeah, you're touching on the true magic of the experience of space flight. Mm-hmm. And this is where everybody kind of struggles for words. Think about everything that you've ever read in a book, everything that's on the internet, the interweb, mm-hmm. Everything that's on there.
Yeah.
Vaguely familiar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's all right there in one picture, looking out the window. Mm-hmm. It's completely different than living on our flat surface down here where you can look off in the horizon and you think you're looking far, but you're not.
Yeah.
And then you could see it all. And there's another little trick that happens. Typically, the lights are on, so your pupils get shrunk down. And when you look out there, you see the bright Earth and the brilliant colors, and it's all beautiful, but you don't see any stars. Because your pupils are, it's like almost like daytime. Everything's so bright. You got lights inside.
Yeah.
So it always looks like the Earth is in complete, utter blackness.
Beautiful, glowing blue planet and just blackness.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. But the visceral thing of everything you ever read happened right there in front of you.
It's like if you were, you met like Keith Richards of the Stones and he was your icon or your idol, and all of a sudden he just sauntered in and he had a beer with you at a bar and you didn't even know how like everything you ever thought of or knew of or that everything you had built up in your mind, and all of a sudden it's right there in front of you, and now it's like, wow. So this is because you have your expectations and what you think and have been trained, and then there it is. And I mean, I can't even imagine about that. We want to talk. Like I said, we have some really fun like space questions, but I really want to also, because you came back, you were on two space, I guess, missions, right? And on the second one, when you were going back into the atmosphere, that one was at nighttime, correct?
It started at night into the dawn.
Can you describe going through Earth's atmosphere at nighttime and what that experience was like?
And before you do, how do you even detach from the space station? I'm fascinated with reentry, and I think it's something no one talks about. Like, I've seen a couple launches from inside the space shuttle, but I reentry seems like and especially with your second mission, you were in control of some sort of floating or some sort of brick with wings.
Just crashing into Earth.
It's got to be a nerve-wracking situation, and you're jiggling the mouse on this thing. So as beautiful as this must be, reentering at night, you're the guy, right?
Yeah, but the training is exceptionally good on how to do this stuff. Plus, you've got a experience of flying high, fast airplanes your whole life kind of thing.
Yeah.
Sure. There's a little bit of, wow, what's this really going to be like? But if you kind of get past all that, the training takes hold and you can fly the airplane. So you asked about undocking.
Yeah.
You're held together by some hooks. So you undo those hooks, and then there are some springs that spring you off of the space station. And then the pilot flies around the space station.
Okay. What?
This is where the pilot learns how to fly a spaceship, so that when they go up again the next time as the commander, when you're going towards the space station, which is a little more critical, you've had some experience.
So you do like a victory lap around the space station?
You do a victory lap around the space station.
Wow.
But it's you're taking really good pictures of the outside. So you can see where meteorites have hit the space station, blah, 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 see with any damage out there.
And now you take pictures of the actual shuttle itself. Use the, how do you pronounce the Canada arm.
Yeah.
Okay, that's right. What it is. So you photograph the vehicle as well.
Yeah. Ever since Columbia, we do a lot of exterior photography of the space shuttle, just to make sure that the tiles are in good shape to come home.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you fly around the International Space Station.
Yes, you fly around, and then for a day, you look at yourself with the Canada arm and the boom and all that kind of stuff. Then you put all that stuff away. You close the doors, the doors are the radiators and all that kind of stuff, and do a deorbit burn to slow yourself down.
Yeah.
And then you ain't staying in orbit anymore. You're coming home.
Yeah.
And you've already used up all your gas up there. So you
describe what a deorbit burn is?
Yeah. So in the direction of motion you're going, you flip the rocket around so that you fire into the direction of motion, which will slow you down.
Yeah.
And as you... because you're now going slower, you're going to fall. Yeah. You've just defined a smaller orbit that intersects the atmosphere.
Of course.
Of course.
Mm. Yeah. So you've packed up all your shit.
Yeah.
Exactly. Here's the thing.
Yeah.
Bob and I are not very good campers. Okay.
Oh, God.
Yeah. In perspective.
Yeah.
We just never got the feel for it,
Right.
And we would wake up in the morning and everything is nicely packed when you go into the situation. On the way back, you just throw your shit in the suitcase, so to speak. I don't care anymore. Like, get me the fuck home.
Yeah.
But you guys have to be meticulous about what's about to happen, because you're about to go into is it the second most dangerous part of the flight, or is it the first?
Yeah, there's no telling.
It really, this is extremely dangerous, what's about to happen. How long does it take from when you undock to when you land?
It takes about the way we do it, and we do it because we plan out the mission this way, it takes about a day and a half.
Really?
Because
do
we want
to sleep while you're hurling towards Earth?
Well, here, there's a reason why. You take all of this imagery of the outside of the space shuttle, and you send it all to the ground, and you have some really smart engineers look at it overnight, make sure everything looks really good. So it takes some time. You got a lot of people involved in figuring all this stuff out.
Yeah.
I mean, you could, if you wanted to. You could undock and be on the ground in 90 minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
It's just like, it's like buzzing the tower. You're just like, sorry guys, I'm coming home early. Screw you suits. Yeah, no.
Do you have emergency landing zones that are...
We do, all over the globe.
One of them is in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Really?
Did you know that?
Which field is it? Is it Fort Wayne?
Bear Field, yeah, Fort Wayne.
Huh. That's no, funny. I didn't.
Yeah.
It would be in the book, though.
It would.
Big,
it's like
a big, giant book of emergency
I believe
exercise.
It's one of the longest runways.
Who knew?
In the Midwest. And I was always waiting for something to
what
go wrong up
Fort
there.
Wayne.
Yeah.
I'm just camping
just
out.
To see that one space shuttle
one.
Coming. But are you coming in, are you just like on fire going through the atmosphere?
Yeah,
what is exactly
you're
that
pretty
like?
Much on fire. You know, you're you get into an area where there's enough density of air molecules. I don't even, can't think of the altitude right now, but about Mach 23, 24-ish, where the air molecules, due to the friction of the heat going into it, the energy, they actually dissociate, and that lets off a whole bunch of heat.
Yeah.
Looks like orange, pink fireball stuff coming over the windshield. It's just beautiful.
And at night, you're never more aware of that.
You can see it outside. You've got like a window to this.
You got great windows out the nose, and that's where the fire is coming over the nose. So you're just inside of a fireball.
It's like a lit firework, and you're in it. Yeah.
How have you oriented the vehicle at this point?
It's about 40 degrees nose up, so you want to show the belly to the to the high velocity.
How do you what kind of control do you have at that point? Do you use engines?
Yes, you do use these little. You have a little. You always preserve a little bit of fuel for your reaction control jets. Those 44 jets I talked about earlier,
so they
can push you around and roll you. But as you get into the atmosphere, and this is all programmed out of experience that we learned in this whole program for decades, your flight controls start to take effect, and in different realms, you use them a little bit more.
Yeah. And where did you land? Were you in the ocean?
That's a wicked cool thought. You know, you do this deorbit burn typically over both my flights. I landed in Florida at the Kennedy Space Center.
Oh wow!
Which is where they want to, because that's where we do
that,
the refurbishment.
They wanted you to land, and with that precision, you can be like, "Yep, I'm going to land right there in Florida."
Yeah. They
like
figured
a dart
all that out.
Coming to Earth, and you can be pinpoint accuracy. That's
sort
amazing.
Of. It's close. What they do, what guidance does, is it drops you off at about 55,000 feet and about Mach 1 directly over the field.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the whole entry algorithm is designed to do. And from there on down, you just look out the window and fly the airplane.
You like corkscrew down?
Mm-hmm. Just like any other glider.
Yeah.
I disagree. I disagree with an astronaut here. Yeah. It's not like any other glider.
Well, so a regular glider, you might be over the field at 1,000 feet and 120 knots. This is 60,000 feet and Mach 1 because it's a brick. Like you said earlier, it's a brick.
Yeah. How do you shave your speed? On the way down?
It's all about the density of air and friction, and you also have a speed brake you kind of use to help with flight control, also help slow you down.
Do you make an announcement to the passengers?
Yeah.
We know you have many choices in space flight. We're glad that you chose
NASA. Yeah. You look out to your left.
I got a
Miami
funny story.
Beach.
Yeah.
I got a funny story.
Yeah.
So when you train for like a year or more. Mm-hmm. And this is when I was a commander, so I knew I was going to be landing the space shuttle in this flight. First meeting I had, got the crew together, went through roles and responsibilities for everybody, talked to the pilot, great guy, and I said, yo, brother, your job is to make sure that I do not fuck up the landing.
Yeah.
And he never said a word about that for a year. He went on about his business to being a great guy and doing all this kind of stuff. And here we are, about 90 degrees to go on final turn, and he goes, hey, Hawk. Yeah. What Guido? What? He goes, don't fuck this up.
In that little calm before the
It
start.
Happened just like that.
Oh.
How fast are you going in miles per hour when you land?
On final, you go 300 knots, which is like 330 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty fast.
And when you finally stop the vehicle, how does that feel?
Presuming you did well.
Yeah.
It's good.
It's you did well.
We see you're here.
Yeah.
We assume it went well enough.
It's good. It's good. It's a really good feeling because it's over a year of work and a lot of thought about how to put all this together. The way it kind of works is they give you a mission, like, we want you to deliver this from Earth to space station and make it work.
Yeah.
Figure out how to do that. So you make your own plan and you know, you have a huge team. Probably 1,000 people, engineers and trainers in Houston, that you put all this together and you figure out how to do it.
Wow. And reacclimation, when you're back on Earth, I read this, and I don't know if this is at all true for you, so if it's not, you can call it out. But I heard that because you get sort of used to it's like you can pass objects around and just kind of float them, yeah, and you don't really need to grip things. So I heard that there was a rumor that a lot of astronauts, when they'd been in space at length, they would like be holding like a cup of coffee or something, and they would just drop it, like things that are so easy that you second nature.
Yeah, I don't think
they
kind of forget.
Well, they try to hand their wife a cup of coffee from 40 feet away.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
here you go.
It didn't go well
Shit,
at all.
Shit, what the fuck?
But did you ever have a thing like you started dropping shit because you forgot that? Oh yeah, that's right. So real gravity takes over here.
The human brain's amazing. You know, when we go out back right now and throw football around, you have programmed yourself to throw the football up in the air because you know it's going to come down that far away.
Yeah, muscle memory.
So if you go into space and you go to throw a football to your buddy, it always hits the ceiling.
Wow.
Because there's no gravity to pull it down. You've been programmed. So once you're in space a while, you figure this crap out, mm-hmm. and you start to throw things on a straight line. So the converse happens when you get back to Earth. And sure enough, it had...
you're trying to throw balls over mountains like Uncle Rico. I swear I can throw this ball. Hell... Way over that mountain over there. I could do it. I could do it. And you're like, oh, nope. That one hit the backyard pool. Well.
Yeah.
But you're right. You got to readjust.
You got to readjust.
In space, that you probably get really good at, you know, passing things off from across the room, you know, and all kinds of things like this. I don't know about you, but I've got, like, we got a few questions we just got to ask about space, just being in as a novice.
But before we do, let's take it away. There's a lot of people that have sponsored this because we're making a ton of money off Ken right now. and so we're going to cut to commercial right now.
Okay, Hell and Back. It is the outrageous R-rated stop-motion animated comedy feature film from the studio that brought you Robot Chicken, Trip Tank, and BoJack Horseman. Hell and Back opens only in theaters nationwide on Friday, October 2nd. After mistakenly taking a blood oath, lifelong friends Remy and Augie embark on a wayward journey into the deepest, darkest depths of hell to rescue one of their best friends, Kurt, before he is sacrificed, naturally. While navigating their escape, they provoke a slew of misfit demons, a super sexy angel, infamous Greek legends, and the devil himself. Hell has never been hotter. Be sure to check out Hell and Back only in theaters starting Friday, October 2nd. Featuring the voices of Nick Swartzen, oh, our good buddy Nick is in this, great, T.J. Miller, Mila Kunis, Bob Odenkirk, Rob Riggle, Danny McBride, and Susan Sarandon. The film was directed by Tom Giannis and Ross Schumann from a script by Zeb Wells, Hugh Sterbikoff, produced by Shadow Machine's Corey Campodonico? How do you spell it? Campodonico? Alexander Bunkley and Eric Beiler. Sorry if I butchered your name there, Corey. You have a really fascinating name. Anyways, Hell and Back, only in theaters Friday, October 2nd. Go check it out.
Welcome back, everybody. We are here with astronaut Ken Ham. I want to take this away from space and back down to Earth, to Dublin, Ireland.
For a moment.
You have a sex toy story.
Yeah. actually that it came out of another question somebody asked me about. What's it like to be an astronaut, like in your life, as a former astronaut?
Yeah.
And this story came to mind about the relevance and the how you compare different occupations, I guess, and how mm-hmm. they stand in the world's eyes. Yeah, so there was this a night where I was in a bar in Dublin, in Temple Bar area, with two lady friends, good friends of mine, mm-hmm. and we're having a few drinks, enjoying the evening, and there was a table of ladies having what they call a hen party, which is a bachelorette party, and they're all kind of getting together over there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decide I'm going to go over there and chat these gals up just for fun. and when you do that, of course, you got to have a rat, right? So into my little pea brain head popped the story that I was going to be a sex toy designer.
But see, the more bizarre it is, the more you almost have to believe it, because who could make this shit up?
Right. So went over there chatting with these gals, said, yeah, I'm from America and I'm a sex toy designer and I'm doing some research and I would like to know what you're looking for in your toys. And, you know, like, you always get a spread of humanity in a group of people, and many of the gals immediately open right up, and they're telling me the most intimate secrets that you may or may not ever want to know. It's kind of interesting stuff. But the whole time, there's this gal in the corner. She's got her arms crossed, you know, universal sign of, I don't believe this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And
I don't approve.
Yeah, and I can see this look. She doesn't believe that I'm a sex toy designer. Mm-hmm. And So blah, 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 it goes on and on. I walk over back over to my two lady friends and I say, hey, here's the deal. I'm a sex toy designer. You're my wife. You're my girlfriend. And we're over here, you know, just exotic story kind of thing. And they walk over and start chatting the gals up too. So now they're believing it even more. But I still got the one unbeliever girl over there in the corner. It goes on, and we decide to leave. And I walk out.
That girl has cock-blocked so many of these girls over time to get there.
I feel like I know the type.
I do. Mm-hmm. We all know the type.
Yeah.
So as we're walking out, this one gal, the malcontent gal that's not believing at all, she grabs one of my friends, and she says, hey, so what's the real deal? Is this guy a sex toy designer? And she's like, no, he's an astronaut. So, and this is the
mic
best part.
Drop.
This is the best part. She runs back over to her friends and she goes, I can't believe we just met a sex toy designer. So, yeah, nobody believes you're an astronaut. They'd much rather know you're a sex toy designer.
Oh, that's so good.
The best.
I'd be like, it's more believable. Obviously, he's got to be a sex toy.
Obviously a sex toy designer.
So, I have just two or three questions. Can I start right out with Mars? Can I just ask if you had the chance, the opportunity to travel to Mars, would you actually jump at the opportunity to go there?
To me, it kind of depends. There are two basic kinds of astronauts. People that want to live in space the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And those that enjoy being Earthlings and coming home. Just like you, John.
Just like me.
I'm an Earthling.
Oh,
I like
good,
I
man.
Respect that.
I like rain. I like hamburgers. I like cold beer. I like all the kinds of things that we like.
Well, you don't get to really high-five anybody else who's living out in space or on Mars with you because you're all on the same boat. It's not impressive to anybody out there. All in it together.
It's all about being impressive.
You come back to Earth.
It's not just that. I mean, if Bob can't bro out, he doesn't want to be there.
You don't want to be there.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Get it. Totally get it. Yeah.
Would you?
So that's the thing.
Wouldn't want to
If there's a clear path to coming home from Mars, I'm in.
The round trip.
Yeah, the round trip.
Okay.
But if it's one of these, you know, go colonize Mars and we'll see you later, never see I'm not so much interested
You've
in that.
Told me a number of times that one of the biggest impediments to getting to Mars, obviously, and you don't hear this a lot in the media. You just hear, oh, we're going to go to Mars, we're going to colonize there, and we'll die there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the getting to there that actually maybe isn't so hard, but it's the radiation that you'll experience while you're out there.
Yeah, radiation is a big unknown. Look at this. Here's a thought for you. What is the highest inclination? I know this is kind of a technical term, but the highest in latitude we've flown in space. It's about 69 degrees, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting number.
Yeah.
We've never flown a polar orbit.
Really?
With human beings, ever. Nobody's ever flown over the poles. And that's because where we fly with International Space Station is protected by the Van Allen belts that surround Earth and protect Earth from all of this nasty radiation that's out there coming off the sun all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The Van Allen belts they look like a donut. So the poles are the holes of the donut, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you flew in a polar orbit, you'd be unprotected for much of your orbit. So we don't do that because it's hard on everything. It's hard on human beings. It's hard on your computers. It's hard on Man, I said hard on way too many times.
But, well, you had sex toys on the mind.
To bring it into perspective, there's a story about the astronauts that worked on the Hubble telescope. And how far is that from the Earth? Can you give people some perspective?
So the space station is about 220 miles to 250 miles.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Hubble is about 330, 350 miles.
Mm-hmm. Many of the astronauts would say that when they close their eyes out there,
mm-hmm.
just 350 mm-hmm. miles away,
mm-hmm.
we're not talking Mars away. When they close their eyes, they would see little points of light.
Yeah, it's actually a streak. Mm-hmm. It's like a high-energy particle that runs through your eye.
Literally, it's like radiation.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, your retina picks it up, or your whatever, the back of your eyeball picks it up. On space station altitudes, you probably see one or two of those a day.
Okay.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. And what I've heard from, and I've known some of these guys that flew in Hubble, you can close your eyes anytime and see, I don't know, whether you would call it a fireworks display, but at least many of these.
That's what they said. They described mm-hmm. it as a fireworks display. And that was just 100 miles out.
Yeah.
Farther out.
Right. From where you were.
Well, think about this, too. This is another great thought about spaceflight. This is a tip of the cap for the guys that went to the moon.
Yeah.
The moon, 250,000 miles away. Space station, 250 miles away. They were 1,000 times farther away.
Yeah. I mean,
it's amazing.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Are we going back there anytime soon? I don't even know.
I hope so.
Yeah, because it's such an impressive thing. There's got to be something. There's got to be something important to test up there because it's just too damn cool. yeah.
Yeah. In my opinion, we need to learn how to live on the moon before we even think about trying to live on Mars.
It's a crawl before you walk.
Exactly.
Agreed. Space crawl before you walk.
Yeah.
How do you get water? Is it true that there's like recycled urine and sweat and all kinds of things going on in the spacecraft or whatever that you can literally take? How do you get water?
I'll give you the cool answer because it's if you're at all interested in science, it's really cool. Space shuttle itself has no solar rays. Mm-hmm. We don't make electricity from looking at the sun. We make electricity from fuel cells, which uses liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen to make electricity. What's the byproduct of that? Water. So space shuttle makes tons and tons of water.
Wow.
In our days of going to space station, we would offload all of this water wow. and in huge, giant bags. They weigh hundreds of pounds and leave it on space station because they need it.
Yeah.
They don't have fuel cells. They don't have liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen. They have solar arrays to make their electricity.
Wow.
So perfect exchange.
Yeah, perfect exchange. And then you take away the space shuttle program, and all of a sudden, space station is like, it's getting dry up here. Yeah, so they get it, you know, that we send them water up, and obviously we've had a couple failures recently of getting service rockets up there to space station to resupply them.
The Dragon, SpaceX?
Yeah, yeah, there's one, and the other one from Orbital Sciences a year and a half ago.
It's not easy, and it's extremely dangerous.
It's exactly. This is a very hard thing to do.
You have some great stories. Have you ever thought about, like, just going on a national speaking tour to talk to people?
Yeah, I don't know. Who wants to listen to me?
You, I want to listen to you. Mm. And I'm your friend. Like, I don't care about you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's the point. Like, I know I do care about you, but yeah, your best friends don't pick up the phone when you call. That's why I've always said that.
Fair enough. Oh, no, it's that guy again.
No. Yeah. No, but seriously,
like,
I'm
fascinated by these stories. Why don't you go out and share this wealth of knowledge with the world?
I would.
The Chivers would show up.
I actually have an agent now. Unify is UNIPHI is the group that does.
Unify needs to put together a national tour for Ken Ham.
Yeah.
Because you're extremely entertaining.
You have all the science and the information, and then you're incredibly charismatic. And not everybody can do that.
God, you're good looking. You're the complete.
Yeah, I'm really busy.
Yeah.
I work for, I'm in the DOD industry and doing really neat stuff, and I don't have any time left.
I know, but every time I try to talk to you about the DOD, you say I can't talk about any of that stuff. And that is the point of a national speaking tour.
Yes.
So that you can talk to people about it.
Right, fair enough. Okay, fair enough.
Anyway, Ken Ham's going on a national tour.
Yeah.
It'll be,
right, here we go.
Organized through...
Somebody set it up. Unify.
Unify, who's probably listening to this now, like, scrambling.
Yeah.
He's been so wildly entertaining. One more question. Little off topic. Do you think anyone's ever had sex in space?
Oh, God, I hope so, yeah.
Yeah. No, seriously.
Yeah,
is it even possible? Like, I mean, really, just thinking about the zero gravity of it.
What would make it impossible? Yeah,
I don't know. Straps? Do you need straps? I don't know how that works. Like,
Those are fingers, right?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Can
I ask one more before we go to the post-apocalyptic questions? Just one more question.
Mm.
Is there something people maybe don't know, maybe something we take for granted here in space that you instantly – I just said here on space – here on Earth, where we are now, that you instantly, once you get to space, you're like, wow, fuck. I know they prepared me for this, but I can't believe – like, is there any – like, things that just kind of shocks you even after you're trained, you know?
There's a whole lot of that. There's not one thing. There's a whole lot of things.
Anything come to mind?
Like,
yeah.
Just eating.
Yeah.
Well, taking a piss.
Yes. I mean,
taking a dump.
No. It's got to. Well, I mean, without
into a vacuum, right? Is it a vacuum?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to put a vacuum on my butt. That would.
You take, so
oh
got
my
the,
God.
The intestines or whatever?
No. So our bodies were designed to operate in 1G. So one Earth gravity.
Yeah.
Without that, things get really messy and ugly.
Uh-huh. Floating around everywhere.
Yeah. Like I mentioned earlier about throwing up in space.
Yeah.
It's really hard. I mean, you're used to,
yeah.
You know, you got a bag and you're used to like throwing up in a bag or something and it goes to the bottom of the bag.
Yeah.
Hey, don't do that in space.
It's just floating.
It just like sits right there.
Were there ever cases where like you puked at zero gravity or somebody else, you know, somehow it didn't get in the bag, and you're like, and then it's floating around, and how do you clean it up?
Yes, and you can imagine that to any kind of fluid you want to think of.
So
you spend a lot of time just cleaning.
Like a nanny on the space shuttle.
So by the way, the pilot's job on a space shuttle mission is to take care of, clean, fix the toilet. That's the honorable job.
You got to do the janitor part right there. That's crap.
Actually, it's human crap. But here's another good story.
No, please.
So, I for a friend, I snuck a little rubber pile of dog shit into space.
Yeah,
and it's amazing how much fun you can have with this thing. Because only in space is it actually reasonable to find a turd floating by. So what I would do is like sit behind, you know, behind a corner when somebody's really busy doing something, like doing some fancy science experiment or something like that. I'd take this pile of poo and just float it out past it in slow motion. And, you know, most of the time, but people will figure it out really quick. You know, their first reaction is always to, like, swim away. You know, do the backstroke. I don't want that turd on me. And then they see it and they'll laugh and all that stuff. I had this one guy who was actually an international, not an American guy up there that I did it to, and he got pissed.
Really?
Oh, he got pissed.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he ran all the way away from the thing. It's like, this turd is coming to get me.
Was it one of the Russians?
No.
I was going to say somebody with no sense of humor, sarcasm, or
Germans.
Was it Germans?
Nope.
Yeah. Okay.
No.
Yeah.
I won't reveal it. Okay. You're wrong. Those are two strikes. You're wrong.
I feel like it'd be good to like catch somebody if they're on the space can, and then you just kind of float it their way. And like, oh shit, when did I?
So we've established that the best sight gag you can pull in space is actually just the classic turd gag.
Yeah.
Or is there
the
better?
Turd gag is great.
Yeah.
I can tell you that. I think I'll tell you the Merkin story if you want to hear the Merkin story.
Oh, you're going to tell it?
Do you want to hear it?
I want to hear it.
Okay, so this is for all the listeners out there.
Tell them what a Merkin is.
Yeah, pull out your phone and Google Merkin, M-E-R-K-I-N.
Yeah.
It's a term that most Americans don't know, and I didn't know it either. I was instructed on the definition of a Merkin by a British gentleman, astronaut, that was on a crew. Anyway, let me set up the story a second. We're doing a high visibility simulation thing before we fly. You know, a lot of people are watching this sim, and quite often you have a fuel blockage or something, and you'd have to redo some valves and figure out how to, you know, get around this thing. And in the debrief of this particular one with a lot of people watching, a British guy in the crew says, must have been Garrett's Merkin. He just said it offhand.
Yeah.
And the debrief goes on, and I go, hey, hang on a second here. Hey, Epi, what was that? It must have been Garrett's Merkin. So we all, you know, have this, what is a Merkin? Turns out a Merkin is, I guess the right way to say it is a pubic wig.
From back in the 1800s.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you obviously know what a Merkin is. It's back in the 1800s when typically, well, you tell a story. Go ahead.
No, they could be, yours was pink? Is it a pink Merkin?
Yeah. The one, well, that's because when you Google it for your listeners out there, and you get touch the wiki link, you're going to get a picture that is a pink Merkin. I'm sure back in the 1800s they weren't pink.
Yeah.
You know, the hardwood floors were not necessarily in vogue back in the day. So to combat crabs, I'm told, you would go for the hardwood floors, but then you had to dress them up differently. So hence the Merkin was born.
So it's like a mustache for women's vaginas.
Correct.
Okay.
That's exactly what it is. So behind closed doors, we became known as the Merkin crew. And
high praise.
Not to be confused with the Americans.
Yeah, exactly, because it's very confusing.
Yeah, Merkin.
And it turns out that there are ways to get things snuck on board the space shuttle. And I won't go into the details of how this one happened, and it was beyond my knowledge. But here's, needless to say, I get into orbit, an hour into the flight, and I get all my helmet off and all that kind of stuff, and I open up the little bag next to me that's got my personal stuff in there that someone else has put there. And out floats this pink Merkin. Poof! Just like floats out in front of me. So I grab it, and I look around. Nobody saw it. This is great. I'm going to save this thing for later. This is the kind of stuff you learn when you're in command, is to use these precious moments wisely. This is leverage, you know?
Yeah.
And fast forward, we had an issue with the space shuttle that turned into a it was going to potentially compromise the mission from a time perspective, and it ended up with a very serious teleconference between space shuttle, my crew, and the ground, mission control, to try to figure out what to do so that we didn't lose this mission. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is it. This is perfect. So down on the mid deck, we set up the teleconference. We got the whole crew in there, and they open it up the mic, and they're talking to the guys in mission control, well, flight directors and all that stuff. And I float upstairs to the flight deck, shuck all my clothes, and put this Merkin on. And I come floating down into the mid deck wearing nothing but a Merkin. And
you just said, I came floating down into the mid deck wearing nothing but a Merkin.
But a Merkin.
A sentence.
Which requires duct tape.
Also a sentence that's never been uttered in human history.
Ever.
You just heard it right now.
And
right
that there, was that's true leadership.
That's right. That's right.
All right. Don't laugh. This broke the tension in a serious moment, and people probably needed that at that moment.
There was a good 5 minutes of laughter where the people on the ground are like, what, what's going on up there? But finally we got our act together, and you're right. The breaking the tension got us, and it all worked out great.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing.
And, I mean, that brings us right into the post-apocalyptic questions, which we've actually it's a little different than it normally is.
So I'll just... You know, we always tell the guests that if you were in a world that had befallen our world, that had befallen a tragedy, and somehow because of it, you were the lone man standing and times were sad and dire, you're alone. But we want to make yours about being in space because, well, come on, we have to. We got to take advantage of it. So, again, you're alone, space, there's nobody out there. And first question, which is the fun, kind of easy one, is... If you had one movie to watch on DVD only, what movie would you choose to watch in space for the rest of your days?
Mm. That's pretty easy. It's not Top Gun.
I respect that.
And it is Caddyshack.
Oh, that's so great. You know when he's thinking, he's talking about the rubber shit. I was just thinking of that scene in Caddyshack. Duty!
Yeah.
In the pool, so.
With the baby Ruth,
I'm glad it came full circle. That's such, I mean, obviously, Caddyshack, winner.
Question number two, bud.
Question number two. All right. So let's just assume for the that there happened to be one other woman on the space shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
And you could choose any woman. We normally say to repopulate the world, but right. I'm just going to say you don't want to repopulate the space shuttle because fuck kids on a space shuttle. You don't
I've had
that.
A vasectomy.
Okay. So let's just say for the pure joy of it that you could choose any woman. I mean, she could be – who's the prototypical woman? Who's the perfect
The
person?
One?
Yeah.
I got the one.
Okay, good.
Yeah. It's okay to mention celebrities. They don't
care. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's the girl from NCIS Los Angeles. The dark hair, Kenzie, is her – I don't know her real name.
Kenzie Bly is – Her name, I think her name is Daniela Rua.
That's it.
Yeah. Yes. She's the tall brunette on the show.
Yes. She's witty and smart and
And just perfect in every way.
You know
what?
I think I can say this. Yeah. She's a rocket ship.
Oh my God. Ken Ham is laying the easy Mac out on Daniela Rua.
Dude, now I want to watch NCIS.
No, we've got her here. Let's bring her out.
Hey! All right. Third and final question. Assuming in your solitude that you are slowly slipping into madness, who is one person you'd like to hallucinate having a conversation with? It can be anybody throughout time. Anybody you want to talk to and have a conversation. Who would that talk be with?
Boy, that's a great question. So I'm already slipping into madness.
Mm-hmm. It's your vision.
And this is probably going to sound because it's right on the tip of my brain, but I'm serious. I would love to sit down and have a long conversation with Bill Murray. I just think that, I mean, the guy, I don't know, there's so many little aspects and elements of his personality that I think I would really enjoy and I don't know, we'd hit it off.
I think you just have the beautiful wry wit. He would have a way of lightening the mood. You're in space alone. How, and he would just be shooting the shit with you. I think it'd be a perfect conversation.
I was amazed at the last golf tournament when he got up on stage and he sung Gloria.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
My God. He freaking rocked it.
He does.
Yes.
He rocked it. And I was just like, in awe of that dude. Mm-hmm.
He secretly, I think he wants to be a rock star.
Yeah.
You know, what's the age old adage? Like, all rock stars want to be movie stars, and all movie stars want to be rock stars.
Exactly.
Right. So, thank you for having us out here. I know, even though you're a Navy football fan, go Notre Dame.
We're 3-0.
Yeah, I don't give a shit.
Oh, we'll see.
Here's the thing. Your coach is amazing.
Oh, hell yeah. Great guy.
Really? You know him?
Oh, yeah.
He's got things put together.
He does, and he's got his team freaking all firing on the same cylinders.
Here's what I know about Navy football, and this is the way I want to bring it to a close. We were on the KCO Black Logger Tour about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and we're just launching the KCCO beer line, which has become this thing that's in like 60,000 locations, and it's one of the more successful ventures that we've gotten into. People thought, oh, it's an internet beer and no one cares. It's actually delicious.
Yeah, I love that stuff.
It's amazing stuff.
And I'm a beer snob. I love it.
Thank you. And we had to go on tour to promote it. You got to really commit to the effort. And I was about 9 stops through the East Coast swing, and I called Ken, and I was like, I don't know if I hadn't hit rock bottom, but I put on a good 12 pounds.
You needed a timeout.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, I got to get away. And at the Navy Academy in Annapolis, you had this great old house. It was like 100 years old.
120
years
old.
120 years old. Mm-hmm. And this attic, the third story wasn't even an attic.
It was the fourth story, yeah.
Yeah.
The penthouse that I could go up. It had internet. It had its own office, its own bedroom. That smell of a house that's 120 years old. It was like walking to your grandfather's. So, it felt like home.
So I got to tell a story. This is how I learned about the Chive. I'm at the chalkboard, and this is really hard to say for a fighter pilot. I'm at the chalkboard doing a class on aerodynamics, and I wrote. This is how I learned how the midshipmen knew about it, and I wrote KCCO on the chalkboard as I'm teaching.
Yeah,
and as I turned around, 2 midshipmen had opened up their uniform shirts and had their green KCCO shirts underneath. I was like, holy shit. And they're like, you rock, everybody loves the Chive out here. So fast forward, you know, John's staying at the house and he'd go running or something, you know, go out and put down a few miles. And he's running around this college campus that loves the Chive. And you can imagine these midshipmen going,
yeah,
wait, is that John Henry?
Like,
I think
why?
They were really confused because civilians aren't really allowed too often on the campus. But I called Ken and said, like, I get nothing left in the tank. I think I'm close to you. I was in Washington, D.C. It was still a ways away. And he's like, man, just change your flight. Get up here.
Yeah.
And just come stay with us. And you can hang out with the mids and just relax. You need to decompress. You can't do this anymore. You're going to kill yourself.
Yeah.
So I literally, like, Ken got me up to Annapolis, and I, you know, I'd go jogging with the midshipmen. We'd hang out at night. Like,
he went to a class. So I'm teaching a class in aerodynamics, and the subject of this class, because obviously John's going to sit in the back of the room, was what kind of airplane should John buy?
And that is, you're not just a great teacher, you're not just a great astronaut, you're just one of my great friends. And for reasons like that, I guess I was the most down that I'd ever been, or at least like the most
disheveled.
I was the most drunk that I've ever been. At least I got to go to Annapolis, to someplace safe that I could call home for a week and just dry off and learn something new, go to classes.
It was cool. It was really cool. Yeah.
Learn a thing or two.
You know, and John's being humble. He actually, you know, bought a bunch of chow, and we had, probably 50 midshipmen over the house to really interact with them and get to know them. And it was a beautiful moment, man. They loved it, and they still talk about it.
I still think about it. So thank you, Ken Ham, for being on the podcast. You're a great dude. You're one of my best friends, and I'm sure all the Chivers appreciate you sitting down and opening up about everything.
No, there's still some stuff I haven't opened up about.
Oh, I know there's not, and that is why you are going to do the speaking tour. Let us know the dates, because we cannot wait to hear all about it. Like, I know you're holding something back, and I think America needs to know what it's like to actually go to space.
Fair enough.
Thank you. You can find us every Thursday, the Chive Podcast on Podcast One. Secretly, you can download it around midnight on Wednesday Eastern Standard Time and start streaming it for free then. And you, it's always free. Thank you, King, for joining us again. And Bob, thanks for coming too, Bob.
I'm glad to be here.
It's rock.
No, thanks, Ken. Seriously, it's amazing.
You bet, man. Yeah.
Good night, Jivers. I'd like to remind you, stay tuned for the latest AP news headlines from Podcast One right after this.
AP Update, I'm Ross Simpson. Already soaking wet from rains today, folks along the eastern coast could fear Hurricane Joaquin will bring 10 inches of rain by next week. The director of the National Hurricane Center in Miami says Joaquin is expected to become a very powerful hurricane.
We're forecasting Joaquin to become a major hurricane within the next 3 days offshore of the southeastern and mid-Atlantic of the United States.
But Rick Knapp says hurricane specialists are planning to get more data to pin down Joaquin's likely path.
We're going to be throwing a lot more aircraft resources at this problem over the next few days because it still is not certain whether or not Joaquin will directly impact the U.S. East Coast or will stay out to sea.
At last report, Hurricane Joaquin was about 175 miles east of the central Bahamas. AP Update, I'm Ross Simpson.